So hello and welcome to another episode of Talk Smart. And today I'd like to talk a little bit about political philosophy and specifically about the social contract. What is the social contract? And in order to explain that, I'd like to start off with a question. I mean, we all know that the government has certain rights over its people. Like, for example, the government has the right to exert under certain circumstances violence. The police is allowed to do that. And the government also is allowed to take part of my personal property away. This is what you call taxation. We have to pay taxes. And the government also is allowed to limit the freedom of people by putting them into prison. And the question that we have now is, who's given the government those rights? Why are they allowed to do that? I am not allowed to lock someone up if somebody's taken away my money. I'm not allowed take somebody else's money. I have to respect other people's property. Now, why is the government allowed to do that? And this is now a fundamental question. And today in this episode, I'd like to talk about this and I'd like to explore this. And to give you a short answer, up to the 1600s, 1700s, up to that time, the kings and rulers, what they had is they claimed to have a so-called a divine right. Essentially, this divine right was given and granted to them. That's what they said, by God. The rulers at that time, the kings and monarchs, they could tax the people because they had a God-given right to do that. Okay, this is at least what they claimed. Okay, now in the 16th and 1700s, at least in the Western world, there was a rethinking started, and this was called the Age of Enlightenment. This is the time when people started to reconsider many of the old ways of thinking, and at that time, the idea of a so-called social contract emerged, and the idea here is that the right of the government to do that is granted not by God, but by the people that the government governs. So it is we, the people, who are giving the government the right to limit the freedoms, to take away some of the property, and so on. So the power, or the justification, or at least the right for the government to do that, comes from the people. Now, this sounds kind of common sense and straightforward. Of course, we know this, that in a democracy, the right comes from the people. We have elections and so on. Yeah, but it's a little bit more complicated than that, because there are even different views on how much the government is allowed to do and how much not. And at that time, in the 16th, 1700s, this is when the idea of a social contract appeared. And the social contract is an agreement, either a formal one or an implicit one, is an agreement between the government and the people that the people are willing to limit their own freedom so that the government has the obligation to take care of them. So in other words, the people are willing to limit or to cede some of their freedoms to the government, and then the government in turn has the obligation to take care of the people. Okay, so this is what you call the social contract, and basically based on this social contract theory, laws and political order are not natural, but essentially they're created by humans. Okay, the people and the government and the monarch, for example, they have formed an agreement, you take care of the people and we are willing to stick to the laws and to the regulations. Okay, that's the agreement. And this is a new idea that came up in the 16th and 1700s with the Age of Enlightenment. And so you see, this is entirely different, because it's before that it was like this. Okay, you have to do that what I tell you to do, because I, as a monarch, have been given the power and the right by God. Okay, and that's why you have to do that what I tell you. Okay. And now with the social contract theory, it's a different way of thinking. It's now like this is that I, as a ruler of a country, am now obliged to have an obligation towards you as the people. Okay. And this is what the many governments these days also have, is they have an obligation to keep the people safe. Okay. And in turn, the people are willing to stick to the laws and to limit their own freedom. And what I would like to do now is, in the next couple of minutes, I would like to explore this social contract theory a little bit more, this agreement between the people and the state and the ruling government, because there are different views. Okay, as a matter of fact, I'm going to talk about three different philosophers here, and they had different views about the social contract theory. So there are some going from one extreme to the other extreme a little bit, and I would like to give you here three different examples here. And we're starting off now with Thomas Hobbes, 1651. And Thomas Hobbes, this guy was a pessimist, okay? He thought that human nature is destructive, and I would like to quote now what he actually has said here. In such condition, there is no place for industry because the fruit thereof is uncertain. So there would not be any production if you leave people on their own without government. Because, you don't know whether there's going to be a result here. And consequently, no culture on earth, of the earth, no navigation, nor the commodities that may be imported by sea. That time, sea trade was already also coming up. There would be no knowledge in the face of the earth. There would be no account of time. There would be no arts, no letters, no society, and which is worst of all, a continual fear and danger of violent death, and the life of man, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. So this is basically the picture that he painted without a government. Okay, that because people by nature are bad, you're going to end up destroying each other. Okay, this is kind of his concern. Yeah, and because of that, that's his solution now, is we need a strong government, a strong leader. Okay, so in the absence of political order and law, everyone would have unlimited natural freedoms. I could simply take your property away. Yeah, there would be the right of all things and war of all against all. And these are his quotes, war of all against all. Yeah. And of course, this is something that nobody wants. So what is his proposal? He proposed we need a strong, powerful leader. And the government's laws may be arbitrary and tyrannical, but in his view, an absolute government is the only solution to prevent the terrifying anarchy of the state of nature. So that is his solution. He says, maybe the government is tyrannical. Maybe it's a dictatorship. But maybe that's the only solution that we have to prevent people killing each other. Yeah, to put it in simple words. Okay. So even advocated of for terror of some power, because otherwise humans will not follow the laws. I mean, this was his pessimistic view of humankind. Huh? So the interesting thing, however, is that the power of this leader does not come from God, but it comes from the people. Now, that might be a surprise by you. Okay, so you have a dictator, and this dictator is legitimized by the people. The people would voluntarily give up their freedom in order to have a powerful leader so that there is social order. This was his view. Wow. Okay, so that's an interesting concept, because normally when we think of dictatorships, we think of, they're kind of against the people. But in his view, the dictatorship is there because the people, would want it, because otherwise the people would end up killing each other. So you see, this is a very extreme view here, but it's of course based on one simple assumption. And the assumption is that humans are bad, are born bad. So a very pessimistic view. Thomas Hobbes is his name. Now let's jump to the other extreme. Okay? So Hobbes promoted a strong, strong government. And now let's, the other extreme view is Jean-Jacques Rousseau. He was a Swiss philosopher, 1762. So a little bit later, almost 100 years later. And he said the following, and his view was entirely different. He said, man is born free, but he's everywhere in chains. We're born free, but we're always chained. Okay, there is so much limit of freedom. And Jean-Jacques Rousseau assumed that people are good. They're born good, but it's society that corrupts them. It's the social structure that corrupts them. As a matter of fact, if you think about becoming a teacher and if you go into education, you might hear of Jean-Jacques Rousseau again, because he also criticized the school system a lot. He said you're kind of forcing the kids into a school system. You want to, where they have to conform to societal rules, to the rule of the school. And he said, no, do away with that. The kids should educate themselves. Let them run around free. Okay. So he was really much in favor of letting nature educate the children, and not some kind of a structure or an organization. Yeah? So you see that he kind of also expanded his political views also into the educational sector. So the laws are made directly by the people. So if you have, if the people are now together, and then what they should do is there is a general will, that's his words. So there's a general collective interest, and then the people sit together, and then they talk about this, and then they form rules and laws. And the general interest, the collective interest, is not the interest of the individual. So it's not like this that you have it like maybe in a democracy where everyone votes because of his or her own interest. But there is, it's a general will, what's the best for the society. And then you sit together and then you come up with a solution, and you don't need a government to do that, because people are free to do that on their own, because we are born free and we are from birth on good. That was his assumption. So you see, it's an entirely different view. Society and government and imposed social structure, that's all bad, because all these things, they corrupt the people. They make people bad. Yeah, that's why you have corruption in the government and so on. Okay. So you see two different opposing views. Hobbes, a very big pessimist. Okay. People are bad from birth on. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, people are good from birth on. You don't need a government in that sense, because people can form their own rules and laws by talking to each other. Yeah. So two extreme views. And of course, there is also a view in the middle. His name is John Locke, 1689. And as a matter of fact, John Locke, his views are quite common nowadays, and many modern democracies are based on his view. And John Locke did not assume that people are good or bad. John Locke assumed that humans are born as a blank slate. He called it tabula rasa. Tabula rasa means it's like a blank sheet of paper. They're not good or not bad, and what comes out of them essentially depends on development. Yeah? People are going to try to better themselves and society. This is what he assumed. It's quite different from Hobbes. Hobbes assumed the people are just going to end up destroying each other. And Locke said, well, actually, people are going to try to make a better society. Yeah, very optimistic in that way. And he did propose and he promoted a limited government. And the job of the government is to protect the people's lives, freedoms, and property. Okay, that is the job of the government. Yeah, the job of the government is to make sure that the people are able to live properly, healthy. Maybe healthcare can go in here. Freedom, okay, freedom from theft, maybe also freedom maybe from other enemy countries trying to invade. And also, of course, property. So if you own something, then this property should be protected. So he also said that men are men, and in this case we talk about mankind, of course, not also including women. But you have to understand this was written many hundred years ago, several hundred years ago, and at that time the word men also referred to mankind, that are naturally free, equal, and independent. Humans are independent. And no one can be deprived of this freedom, and no one can be subjected to somebody else's political power unless they agree to it. Okay, so it is like this, that I have to agree to it for a political power to limit my freedom and my property. So that is the thing, and this is where we have now the social contract. I agree that the government has certain powers over me because I give this power to the government by voting, for example. This is the only way that one can strip off this natural liberty, and is to agree with other people. So essentially, when I have a certain natural liberty and I want to take it away, to have the only way that to take this natural liberty away is that when I agree with other people, okay, you are allowed to limit my freedom, because this is what we need to have a functioning society. Yeah. So it is essentially a very good approach, in the sense that it kind of is a very pragmatic approach, I think. And many representative democracies that we have nowadays are based on this system. Now, what is a representative democracy in comparison to a direct democracy? In a representative democracy, we the people are voting for leaders that make the laws on our behalf. So I don't make the laws myself, okay? But I'm voting for people who do that for me. That's why you vote for certain political parties. And in a direct democracy, there's some countries that have a very strong tradition also in a direct democracy. For example, Switzerland is one of those countries. There, the people can directly vote, or have a much stronger possibility to directly vote for certain laws. Okay. So that is essentially the thing that John Locke said. We basically give away some of the freedoms that we have voluntarily, and we agree to that. I agree to that. And for that purpose, other people are now allowed to exert a certain power over me. For example, they're making the laws, and I am agreeing to follow those laws because that is part of the contract, part of the agreement. Okay, so you see that those three people, they had a very, sometimes very different assumptions also on the basis of human nature. And then from that, they kind of followed the consequences. To summarize again, Hobbes had a very pessimistic view. Humans are bad from birth. Jean-Jacques Rousseau had a very positive view. Humans are naturally free and are naturally good. Yeah, and it is society and the government that corrupts people. And John Locke, he had a very pragmatic approach. I think he says, well, we are actually neither free. We are free, but we're neither good nor bad. But we're simply blank slates. And what we're doing is we're giving up voluntarily these natural freedoms that we have because we want to form a functioning society. Okay. Now, some social contract theorists actually go quite far, and they say that it is possible, of course, when the government does not do its job and does not fulfill its part of the contract, for example, is abusing the power and not taking care of the people, well, then you have the possibility to vote and vote the government out of office. That's what we are aware of. And some social contract theorists even say, well, actually, maybe sometimes revolution is also possible. Yeah? So some of these folks actually say that, if elections don't work, then a revolution and violence might also be, justified. That's a strong one, right? Again, I'm not saying that I'm in this view, but this is simply when you read through the different philosophical views here, these are the different views that people have, okay? Or philosophers had. Some said it's okay if the government is not willing to stick to its part of the social contract, then it's possible to have a revolution. As a matter of fact, Jean-Jacques Rousseau's view later was picked up by the French Revolution. Yeah? And this is, you see that those philosophical views, they had a strong strong impact also on the development of history. So what are some of the criticisms or some of the issues or dangers of the social contract view? And there are two of them that are kind of interlinked here. Sometimes there is the problem that the government might claim too much power and just say, well, we need this power to protect the public. Yeah, actually, they don't need that power, but they're saying, okay, we need this power in order to protect the public. Or sometimes the government might create fear in the public simply to justify wide-reaching laws. I'll give you an example here. Because of terrorism, many governments have now said, okay, we have to take anti-terrorism measures, and it's like, let's put up video cameras everywhere, and let's start to monitor the email and check the emails that the people write. It's a very big impact on privacy here. And it's sometimes been justified with the statement, we have to do that because we want to protect you. Yeah, don't you want to be protected? Okay, well, then you have to agree that those civil liberties that you have, like all the right of privacy and so on, well, you got to give up on that, otherwise we're not able to protect you. And then, of course, there's the criticism that says, well, actually, no, you don't need erode our civil liberties to that extent in order to protect us. It's not necessary. Yeah, you're just creating a fear, which is not even there to that extent. Yeah, or you're just using this as a pretext to gain more power. So this would be the counter argument here, right? And there's, of course, the worry in some cases that this leads to so-called a slippery slope. Where is this going to end? Okay, if we now start to take more and more of the freedoms of the people with the argument that we need these things, these rights to monitor you, what you're doing and where you're going and all of the video surveillance, we need that. Well, in order to protect you, well, where is this going to end? Okay, how much more of our freedom do we have to give away? Yeah? And is it really necessary? So that's why you have to sometimes this political debate is to what extent do you actually need those rights to monitor what I'm writing in my email and I'll have to have the video surveillance and all of these things. Okay? Is this really necessary for you to fight terrorism? Yeah? Or are you just saying that? Or are there not better methods? And how can we balance this? Yeah? Or could it not be that the loss of civil liberties may have such negative consequences that it might even be worse than some of the consequences that the government says are going to happen? Yeah, maybe it's just fear-mongering. So you see, it's where can you draw the line here? Okay, I give you a very current example here. One that is that you're all probably aware of these days is because during the corona pandemic, the government does impose certain mandates. People have to wear face masks. Or the discussion now is, should there be a mandatory vaccination? Yeah. So in one hand, you can say, okay, well, actually, I have a certain freedom. I don't want to wear face masks. It's my right not to wear them. It's my right not to get vaccinated. It's my individual freedom. Yeah. That's what some people are saying. And then the government says, but my job as the government is to protect the people, yeah, from a dangerous disease. And I have to now reduce the right and the freedom of the people in order to protect the majority of people. Right? So you see here, we have again the whole issue here. And if you would pick up Thomas Hobbes' view, then he probably is going to say, well, I mean, the government should do this dictatorially. Everyone's got to get vaccinated. If not, then I don't know. Yeah. Jean-Jacques Rousseau was kind of pleading a little bit more to the thing is, people should find themselves and there should be a common agreement to do that what's best. Yeah. Because they will sit together and the collective interest would be to avoid the pandemic and to get rid of the pandemic, and they would sit together and voluntarily form the agreement. Okay, let's wear face masks and everyone should get vaccinated. Yeah, and I think this is a little bit of an explanation of why there are so many different views. And if you are ever involved in a debate, in a political debate where there are different views, my suggestion here is be a little bit more advanced and a little bit more educated than just trying to convince the other person of your own political view. But rather take a step back and then ask yourself, okay, which system or which format of the social contract theory does this other person follow? See, more the one of Hobbes, the more of Locke, or the more of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. I think it's much more interesting question than trying to convince the other person that you're right and he's wrong or she's wrong. Yeah, so you generally cannot convince other people anyway. Yeah, but if you pull it on a more philosophical or TOK level, where you can talk about the different social contract approaches and theories, I think it makes it much more interesting, because I think then everyone can learn from each other. And you can say, yeah, I actually have a more of an, I don't know, a John Locke approach to this topic, and you have more, I don't know, yeah, a Jean-Jacques Rousseau approach or Hobbes approach, whatever. I think it's much more interesting to approach the topics on this academic level. Than simply on a talking point level where you're trying to convince the other person that you're right, yeah, and he's wrong or she's wrong. Yeah. So yeah, what I'm going to do now is I think I'm slowly going to call it quits. I think social contract theory has many more points and aspects to it, but generally I think those three philosophers, not the only ones, huh? But those three philosophers are quite nice to use here because. Yeah, they have quite different assumptions on human nature and, of course, also what follows from that in relation to the government that the people have. Okay, enough for now. I wish you all the best and see you around next time. Bye-bye.